You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the May 2018 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's the continuation of Megan's World by Josh Duboff. This is the life of casual travel and nights out that Markle will have to leave behind, even if she manages to maintain the friendships. As royal commentator and author Heather Cox told me, perhaps the surest sign that the Toronto friendships are authentic is that we haven't heard much from the socialite squad since Markle and Harry's relationship went public. She does seem to have a good sort of inner circle, Cox says. None of them are out being photographed by the paparazzi or interviewed about any of this. I think those are probably the friendships that are real, the ones that you don't see, because those are ones that you trust. Mulroney and Nunu both declined to comment for this piece. The British socialite Violet von Vestenholtz, who is credited with setting up Harry and Meghan on the blind date that started it all, also declined to talk about her friendship with Markle. Von Vestenholtz met Markle through her work in press relations at Ralph Lauren. Her father is friends with Prince Charles, and she knew Prince Harry growing up. The discretion continues. Mulroney reportedly visited Markle in London for 4 days in January to help her with her wedding dress fittings, and was not so much as photographed the entire time she was there. Last September, Markle wore one of Nunu's designs, a white blouse called the husband shirt, to the Invictus Games, an event founded by Prince Harry, but Nunu refuses to comment on how Markle's endorsement may have affected sales. Markle brought Anderson along to the games, a full-circle friendship moment for the pair. Her Harry-era crew was totally on lockdown, Louis notes. I think that's super smart of them. Because, first, they're hoping for an invitation to the wedding. Why would you jeopardize that? And number two, her social circle in Toronto is quite affluent. They don't need to sell a story to the Daily Mail for $10,000. Markle also has a group of Hollywood friends whose names are better known to the public. Quantico star Priyanka Chopra, tennis legend Serena Williams, timeless actress Abigail Spencer, True Blood's Janina Gavankar. Most of them have talked about Markle since she started dating Harry, in the course of giving interviews. Their comments, however, generally take the form of vague platitudes, and none of them have been seen in public with Markle since she became a household name. Spencer, who recurred on Suits for 5 seasons alongside Markle, shared details about her friendship with the soon-to-be royal with me, and when I ask if she has been in touch with Markle since she started dating Harry, responded simply, "Of course, she's my friend." Spencer says of their relationship, "She is definitely my go-to for not only career advice, but all things advice. I call her my life curator. Her taste is impeccable, and because of our similar nature, I know she really gets me." According to Spencer, Markle has acclimated to the increased attention well. Meghan has been a famous and successful actor for a very long time. She's handling it as she handles everything, with grace, ease, humility, a sharp wit, and a deft sense of humor. Spencer also underscores Markle's commitment to her friends. She finds her tribe and loves them hard. Gavankar, who met Markle at a diversity talent development program, says Markle was her first girlfriend in Los Angeles, and now her oldest. She also says she has been in touch with Markle since she and Harry began dating. and observed that Merkel has no confusion as to what is important. She isn't distracted from her priorities, her family, her chosen family, and what she puts into the world. Gavankar says that Merkel takes her friendships seriously, and that the two of them, almost always in different cities, on location, have FaceTime or Skype sessions, which they call State of the Unions. Gavankar notes, with some laughter, they are full-bodied rundowns of all the moving parts in our lives. Realizations in personal growth, priority organization, nudges on self-care, mostly her nudging me. Merkel also has her longtime Los Angeles friends, about whom the least is known, since they, for the most part, keep an extremely low profile. Benita Litt, a brand curator, has been close with Merkel for years, and Merkel spent Christmas with the Litt family in 2016. One imagines Heather Dorak is on a group text thread with Litt and Merkel as well. Dorak, a Pilates instructor based in Los Angeles, visited Spain with Merkel in 2016 and used to appear in photographs often with Merkel and Litt. And in her own special category is New York BFF Lindsay Jill Roth, Merkel's best friend from Northwestern, currently a television producer. Merkel was the maid of honor in Roth's 2016 wedding. Merkel clearly has no shortage of pals to text with, even if she can't see them as often or tag them in sun-kissed photos taken in foreign countries. She can't go to Whole Foods without it becoming a four-day news cycle story. Shortly after their engagement, Harry said in an interview that Merkel is marrying into the family she's never had, a remark which, particularly in the British press and among Merkel's own family members, caused a stir. Merkel has spoken publicly several times about her close relationship with her mother, Doria Ragland, but less is known about her relationship with her father, Thomas, a former lighting director who currently lives somewhat under the radar in Mexico. Harry had met Ragland, but not Thomas, when he and Meghan became engaged. Merkel's two half-siblings, Thomas's children from a previous marriage, are not likely to be giving toast at her wedding either, as she is reportedly estranged from both. Samantha is said to be writing a tell-all memoir. Thomas Jr. spoke to the press in January about the pressures of having a suddenly extremely high-profile relation after an altercation with his fiancée, who was initially charged with fourth-degree assault but did not face prosecution. Some of Merkel's childhood friends have attempted to capitalize on their associations as well, such as Ninaki Pretty, who provided information to the press, including a photo of a teenage Merkel standing in front of Buckingham Palace, and a video of an 8-year-old Merkel dressed up like the Queen. And according to Deadline Hollywood, Merkel's ex-husband, Trevor Ingelson, to whom she was married from 2011 to 2013, is currently producing a television program with Fox, inspired by his relationship with her. While Harry's phrasing may have been extreme, it's true that Merkel will gain a new family circle, her husband and his network of close confidants and friends, plus Prince William and Kate, who will live in the same complex with them in Kensington Palace. The British tabloids are already having a field day analyzing the dynamic between Merkel and her future sister-in-law, the Duchess of Cambridge. Cox notes that while they seem to be getting along just fine, it's an unusual amount of scrutiny to place on a sister-in-law relationship. Their getting along doesn't mean they'll be braiding each other's hair, and I think the pressure is only going to increase, especially because the most recent analog for them in the British royal family is obviously Diana and Fergie, Sarah Ferguson, Duchess of York, who I think were very close at the beginning. Then there was the question of whether Fergie's more outgoing persona had an influence on Diana. whether Diana influenced Fergie in different ways, and how symbiotic that relationship was, and I think people will probably be starting to look to that. It's possible Markle will have trouble reconciling the life she once led, in which she could enjoy the freedom to travel and the ability to maintain a fairly low-key existence when she wanted to, with the new reality she faces. She can't text Anderson to join her in an hour for dinner at a London hotspot, or fly to meet Litt and Durack for a Miami girls' weekend. Such plans will have to be carried out with extreme discretion and attention to logistics. It's interesting to note that there has rarely been a photograph of Kate just hanging out with a friend since she married William, and there are hardly ever shots of her with Sister Pippa anymore, either. Nash says that the royal family is extremely well practiced in organizing such private visits. William and Kate have a very close circle of friends who they can absolutely trust and rely on for their discretion. They'll host people at Anmer Hall or Kensington Palace or visit them at their country houses. The UK press also plays along, Nash says, largely adhering to guidelines over the use of paparazzi imagery, which is another reason it might feel like we don't see them out and about. But it's hard to make any predictions about what Markle's future in the royal family will bring. It is possible that Markle will chart a different course than those before her. Giovanni notes that she has a Lone Ranger quality to her, despite having so many friends. Her worldliness and independent streak could very well be an advantage. Giovanni remembers talking to Markle at a Toronto party about the time she spent in Buenos Aires. She worked at the U.S. Embassy there for a few months during her college years, and contemplating how adaptable she seemed. One thing that makes me think she could easily absorb the role is that she's picked herself up and lived in many different parts of the world, he says. She's a bit of a shapeshifter, able to adjust to any social context. And, of course, this is not the royal family of Diana's era, or even Kate's. What the palace learned from the Diana and Sarah Ferguson experience is that allowing royal wives to keep strong relationships with their families and old friends is really important, Treble notes. While Cox acknowledges that Markle's anonymity is gone unless she starts wearing wigs, she thinks the couple might continue to take a less conventional approach to how they fulfill their duties, one that Harry's relative distance from the throne makes possible. If Markle is as interested in philanthropy as she appears to be, maybe she can try to push the boundaries a little bit. I would think that all the ingredients are there for her to carve out a bit of her own space, especially if she has Harry's backing. And I think because he's not the direct heir, they might have a little more room to challenge things, Nash concurs. I think she will potentially have more freedom than other royal wives. Harry and Meghan are not preparing to become king and queen one day. However strong her existing friendships remain, Markle is likely to make new friends who will understand the day-to-day stresses of her current station quite well. Challenging as it will be for her to maintain some of her earlier ties, especially with the responsibilities of her new role, her resourcefulness, as well as the loyalty of her friends and evolving royal family mores, could work in her favor. And anyway, she's probably created a private Instagram account. Harry Ever After. After a string of romances left him brokenhearted, Prince Harry met the one. Royal correspondent Katie Nicholl reveals how the Queen eased Meghan Markle's way into the family. Opening photo, Meghan Markle and Prince Harry in Botswana, August 2017. This article is adapted and expanded from Harry, Life, Loss, and Love by Katie Nicholl, Hachette Books, 2018. It took just one date for Prince Harry to realize that Meghan Markle was different. The couple first got to know each other in July 2016 over a bottle of chilled rosé at Soho House on London's Dean Street. They had already connected on Instagram and evidently liked what they saw. A mutual friend, Violet von Westenholtz, gave Meghan's number to Harry and suggested he call her. Another pal in common, Marcus Anderson, who works at the private members club, cleared rooms and corridors so they could meet in secret without the fear of being spotted, according to a friend. After several dates, Harry invited Meghan to join him on a holiday in Botswana, where their love blossomed. He has since said that the stars were aligned. By royal standards, Harry and Meghan's courtship has been whirlwind and heartwarmingly romantic. Given their public profiles, it's astonishing that they were able to keep it clandestine for months, swearing close family and best friends to absolute secrecy. They also made a pact to see each other every 2 weeks, with Harry tailoring his visits around Meghan's filming schedule on Suits. Over the ensuing months, they racked up thousands of frequent flyer miles, jetting between London and Toronto, Harry going commercial with just a single protection officer in tow. By October, though, the cat was out of the bag, and by Christmas, Meghan was calling Kensington Palace home. Then, at his best friend Tom Inskip's wedding in Jamaica the following spring, those close to Harry took note. The prince had never looked so in love. They rightly predicted that he would be the next royal down the aisle. On that trip, only a year ago, it was 2 weeks since they had last been together, and both had been looking forward to the occasion. Harry had arrived on the island via a commercial flight, while Meghan flew in on a friend's private jet. The wedding was a 3-day celebration, so Harry had gone all out on a luxury oceanfront villa at the Roundhill Resort in Montego Bay, not far from where Meghan had married her first husband, Trevor Ingelson, 6 years before. Harry and Meghan spent much of their time tucked away in their villa, which had its own infinity pool and on-call butler. At the wedding service, Meghan mingled confidently while Harry ushered people to their seats. She already knew most of Harry's inner circle, and she got along well with Tom's future wife, Laura, who, like many of Harry's friends, felt that Meghan was a positive influence. At the reception that night, Harry barely left Meghan's side. When the DJ started playing, they took to the dance floor and partied into the early hours, but Harry was on his best behavior, limiting his drinking and even his beloved Marlboro Lights. Harry's mood soured only when they were photographed together on their balcony by a paparazzo, but Meghan comforted him, reasoning, "What does it matter? Nothing should spoil this trip." As they bid each other farewell at the end of the holiday, both knew that they were moving toward something much more serious. Meghan was preparing to film her 7th season of Suits, and she had already decided that it would probably be her last. If things with Harry were to go to the next level, she knew that one of the sacrifices she would likely have to make would be her career. It was something his exes Chelsea Davis and Cressida Bonas had not been prepared to do, but Meghan felt differently. She was older and perhaps wiser, and wanted to focus on her charity work anyway. Harry, meanwhile, was convinced he had met the one. At nearly 32, he He was the same age as his father when Prince Charles married Lady Diana Spencer. Prince William, meanwhile, had already married and become a father by the same point in his life. According to former royal chef Darren McGrady, who cooked for the brothers when they were young boys living at Kensington Palace, "I remember Diana once told Harry and William, 'Do what your heart tells you.' She wanted them to follow their hearts, and I think that's exactly what Harry's doing." As fifth in line to the throne, Harry was required to ask his grandmother's permission to wed. Decades earlier, Princess Margaret had asked the Queen for her blessing to marry divorcee Peter Townsend, but her sister refused to give her blessing because of the fear that it would create a backlash against the royal family for approving divorce. The storyline was reprised on The Crown, but as royal historian Hugo Vickers pointed out last year, times have changed. On paper, Meghan's everything you don't want her to be, an older woman, a divorcee, but actually her more positive qualities could suit her well for the role of a royal consort. She has a certain worldly experience and can stand very well on her own two feet. I think most people think she would make a very good partner for Prince Harry, and I am sure the Queen would give her permission for Harry to wed Meghan. It was a sentiment many shared, and it proved true. When Harry asked his grandmother for her blessing in the fall of 2017, she gave it without hesitation. "I was told by one of the Queen's closest aides shortly after the engagement announcement that the monarch was genuinely delighted that Harry had found someone who made him so happy. Despite rumors to the contrary, there was no issue over Meghan's racial heritage or concerns that she was older or divorced." Exceptionally close to her grandson, the Queen trusts Harry. At points in his life, she has taken on a maternal role, particularly in those difficult months and years after Diana's death. The Queen has gone out of her way to include Meghan from the outset, from inviting the actress to Buckingham Palace for tea to welcoming her to the family's Christmas celebrations at Sandringham in Norfolk, a tradition previously only ever reserved for spouses. And behind the closed doors of Buckingham Palace, Meghan has gone down as a great success. The Queen likes her, and she charmed the Duke of Edinburgh over Christmas. "He was very impressed by her intellect and how well-read she was," says a family friend. Even the Queen's corgis are fans. According to Harry, who joked he has spent his life being barked at, Her Majesty's dogs took instantly to Meghan. Harry, meanwhile, has instructed aides to be helpful and inclusive. Even in the early days of their courtship, Meghan had a direct line to Harry's private secretary, Edward Lane Fox, and his communications secretary, Jason Knauf, who have been instrumental in helping her adjust. And then there are the symbols. The wedding is taking place at Windsor Castle, the Queen's home and favorite residence. I was told Harry had always set his sights on getting married at St. George's Chapel, and the Queen has let the couple take the lead as they plan their wedding. Harry and Meghan have been told there is no template they need to stick to, says a royal source. They can invite who they want, and the day is theirs to plan as they choose. It was not so long ago that the Queen and Prince Philip celebrated their diamond wedding anniversary at a private soiree at Windsor Castle. No doubt, the monarch and her subjects hope that Harry and Meghan will enjoy a similarly long and fruitful union. Ever since he was a little boy, Prince Harry has held a special place in the collective heart of the nation, and he has proved to be a real asset to the royal family. Diana told Harry to marry for love, and he is. Meghan loves him back. Here's to his happy ever after. Royal Rewind, legendary photographer Milton Jindal recalls an idyllic vacation with the Queen at Balmoral, her private retreat in the Scottish countryside. In the photos, a summer in the Highlands, 1976. Queen Elizabeth at ease, Balmoral Castle. Two of the guns, Prince Edward, foreground, and Prince Andrew, after a shoot and a picnic lunch. The photographer's daughter, Anna, with her godmother, Princess Margaret. The Queen said, "Come and help me decide what to do with 100 yards of tappa cloth the Queen of Tonga very generously sent me." It was the summer of 1976. We were at Balmoral, the neo-Gothic castle built in Scotland on an estate acquired by Prince Albert for Queen Victoria in 1852. It was intended from the start as a country retreat for the royal family. I had had some trepidation when Princess Margaret, a close friend of my late British wife and our daughter's godmother, asked if I would come and bring Anna to Balmoral. Although Princess Margaret had become a family intimate, and I had often met the Queen and other members of the family, the concept of royalty remained, for an American, anachronistic. I remember my astonishment at the swarms of women gathered around radios in New York department stores in 1936 to hear Edward VIII announce his abdication. Before that, my only previous brush with matters royal had been at Columbia, where the chapel choir wore red robes, a privilege bestowed by the crown before the American Revolution, when the university was called King's College. The first day and night at Balmoral were a relief. Despite the grandiose setting, the atmosphere was relaxed. Besides the Queen and Prince Philip, the young princes Andrew and Edward were there. So were two equerries to the Queen, Blair Stuart Wilson and Robin Broke, and a lady-in-waiting, Rose Baring. The front hall was dominated by a monumental statue of Prince Albert. All around were Edwin Landseer portraits of gillies. Their eyes rolled heavenward, as I recall, like those of saints painted in the Baroque manner. I was roused my first morning by a bagpiper, the family alarm clock. During my 10-day stay, overnight guests were few. Perhaps the most striking visitor was the moderator of the General Assembly of the Church of Scotland, who wore knee breeches and shoes with prominent silver buckles. One afternoon, I happened to meet the Queen in the garden. She asked me to come to the front lawn, where a vast array of patterned fabric had been laid out, a present from the Tongans. She thought to use the fabric as wallpaper for a room in the castle, and I agreed that this was a good idea. On some days there were excursions into the country. The Queen had been taught to drive by auxiliary army officers during World War II, and she handled a Land Rover with intrepid skill on the hilly and winding roads. When we went riding, she saddled her horse, and afterward carried the saddle back to the stable herself. At a shoot on the grounds, a truck delivered a sumptuous buffet lunch. The guns lay on the grass for a postprandial respite. The Queen and her sister walked about, deep in conversation. They were very close. When apart, they telephoned 2 or 3 times a day. The atmosphere was always agreeable, buoyed by the light touch of the Queen and her sister. When Anna and I were leaving, and the Queen was seeing us off, I said, "Ma'am, do you mind if I take a picture?" "Not at all," she replied, "but I'm amazed that you have any film left."
Thank you.
Palace and Prejudice. Reflecting on his own royal romance, Atish Tasir contemplates what Meghan Markle's entry into the House of Windsor symbolizes in the era of Brexit. Opening photo, the author and Lady Gabriella Windsor attend a party at Althorp House, 2006. In a louche past life, I was almost a member of the British royal family. In the early 2000s, I dated Ella Windsor, the daughter of Prince and Princess Michael of Kent. Prince Michael was first cousin to the Queen and married to the unpopular Princess Michael, whom the British press had labeled Princess Pushy. For 3 surreal years, Ella and I hung about Kensington Palace. We swam naked in the Queen's pool in Buckingham Palace. We did MDMA in Windsor Castle, and we had scrapes with the British press, who, due to a misadventure of mine as a peer health educator at Amherst College, reported the story of our relationship with the mortifying headline, "Princess Pushy Delighted Over Her Daughter's Romance with India's Captain Condom." There were schlosses and boats and stag shoots in Scotland. The cozy-crowned heads of small Eastern European countries cooked us lamb chops late at night and told us tales of Nazis and communists. It was a wonderful way to spend one's 20s. Ella and I met in America. I had just graduated from Amherst and was living as a lodger in the Bowery loft of the feminist Kate Millett. I grew up amid the depredations of socialist India. My father was a Pakistani businessman and politician who abandoned my mother when I was 2, leaving her to support us through a career in journalism. And as a reaction, no doubt, I developed a taste for cafe society in New York. After college, I found myself among a group of idle, beautiful people. Ella and I were introduced by friends in common at my housewarming party. She was still at Brown, while I had just begun working as a reporter at Time magazine. We spent a few blissful months in New York before Time sent me to its London bureau. It was then that I found myself in the orbit of the Windsors for the first time. Ella's parents lived in a 5-bedroom royal apartment in Kensington Palace, where Ella had grown up. A long, discreet drive marked private road, a lion and unicorn standing sentinel, led from Kensington High Street to the palace, KP as it was known in the family. A couple of policemen with walkie-talkies would wave me in with what sounded like the first line of a limerick. "Ah, you're the Indian fella who's going with Gabriella." The warren of dark brick apartments and offices that greeted me resembled something between a military hospital and an old people's home. All the famous inhabitants, Princess Margaret, Princess Diana, were dead, and those who remained, minor royals and palace secretaries, lived in their long cold shadow. In perpetual fear, I should add, of being turfed out. Ella's parents had lived there for the past 25 years, and the Queen had paid their rent in gratitude for the many duties they undertook in her name. After a public outcry, though, the Kents were forced to begin paying their own rent in the late 2000s, estimated to be about £10,000 a month. The British, with their many class anxieties and resentments, hate how much they love their royal family, and one of the ways they express this quixotic love is through a naked hatred of minor royalty. The position of the Kents, low down in the food chain, roughly the equivalent of the Deputy Secretary of Transportation in the American line of succession, as my college magazine rudely pointed out, was especially precarious. They should have been nobodies, just left alone to lead a civilian life. But Prince Michael, the younger brother of the Duke of Kent, was first cousin to the Queen, and that made him a somebody. An unshakable HRH clung to his name. It was an official designation, and it meant that, as Her Majesty's representative, he had to carry out a whole range of duties, from patronizing charities to giving prizes. Even Ella was not spared. Here, breaking a bottle of champagne on the bow of a boat, there, opening the Newbury horse races. I have happy memories of KP. Burmese cats in window seats and wooden commodes, deep bathtubs and walled gardens. But the truth is that until Will and Kate arrived to liven up the place, Kensington Palace was wildly depressing. Princess Michael, recently in trouble again for wearing a racist blackamoor brooch to her first lunch with Meghan Markle, was famously scandal-prone. During the week Ella was graduating from Brown, her mother was on the cover of the New York Post under the headline Royal Bigot. She had apparently told some noisy diners of color at Da Silvano, an Italian restaurant in Greenwich Village, to go back to the colonies. "I would never have said that," she later confided to me. "I'm a historian. I know that America itself was a colony." She feigned an odd mixture of injustice and contrition. "I daren't even say I want my coffee black anymore. I say without milk." I would have liked to believe her, but I had my doubts. It was not that her father had allegedly been an SS officer, albeit a reluctant one. Royals and Nazis go together like blini and caviar. It was that everyone above a certain age in Britain is at least a tiny bit racist. The colonial past made it almost second nature for Britons born at the tail end of the Raj to treat roughly a quarter of the planet as subject peoples. I was one of the first natives of that former empire to be dating a member of the royal family, and soon Gary Lewis, a Maori builder and surfer, married Lady Davina Windsor, daughter of the Duke of Gloucester. Princess Michael, though generally free of British colonial prejudices and beyond reproach when it came to me, nevertheless invited trouble out of what felt like a desire to shock. Her pair of black sheep in Gloucestershire were named Venus and Serena. Most everybody thought she was perfectly ghastly, but I saw a nice side of Princess Michael. She could be funny, intelligent, generous, and she was a lot more industrious than the other royals. She wrote books and decorated houses. Her tragedy was she never understood that element of understatement that is so much the secret of survival for the royal family. "Well, Dickie," the Queen is reported to have said when Lord Mountbatten, Earl of Burma and Prince Philip's uncle, first spoke to her of Princess Michael as a prospective bride for Prince Michael, "she sounds a bit too grand for us." And she was, now chiding people for calling her Marie Christine instead of Your Royal Highness, now tracing her lineage back to Charlemagne. Poor Princess Michael. She failed to acquire that one quality that is the supreme attribute of British royalty, coziness. Prince Michael was cozy. Prince Charles is cozy. The Queen, by all accounts, is a tea cozy. But Princess Michael was, fatally, about as cozy as a yellow jacket on speed. She was Marie Antoinette in a nation that finds bananas too exotic. I've been thinking a lot about Princess Michael lately in the context of William's and Harry's conjugal choices. She was of the firm belief that it was a bad idea for royalty to marry commoners. It's all very well Ella marrying Mr. Taseer from India or Pakistan, she once said to me. No one knows what to do with that. But the moment the girl down the road thinks she can be princess or queen, it's all over. The mystery is gone. And yet, here we are. It seems the Windsors have gained new relevance precisely through a process of demystification. William and Harry have lived out the truth of Lampedusa's The Leopard. If we want things to stay as they are, things will have to change. Kate Middleton, the daughter of an air hostess, is future queen. And now there is Meghan Markle, a divorcee and an actress of mixed race, both unthinkable for a family that routinely demanded the sacrifice of big love at the altar of respectability. Princess Margaret was made to break things off with group captain Peter Townsend, a divorcee, and when Edward VIII refused to give up American socialite Wallace Simpson, also a divorcee, he had to give up the throne. The Crown, the TV series, would not exist were it not for these sacrifices, and yet Prince Harry will marry Markle in May, and she will likely become HRH Duchess of Sussex. Far from being ill-advised, the new face of the royal family appears to be a public relations coup. In the post-Brexit malaise of modern Britain, the young royals are the one bright spot. As a member of the extended family said to me in confidence, they're young, they're diverse. We've never really had anything like that, and they're a great calling card when everything else is looking so gray. He added, both those girls are a lot more professional than our politicians. They understand their place and what they need to do to be legitimate, not to mention cozy. It is hard to exaggerate the catastrophe that Brexit has been. It is something much more than an economic disaster, though it is that too. The government's own Brexit analysis, leaked earlier this year to BuzzFeed, predicted that every sector of the British economy, save for agriculture, would be negatively impacted, and that in every possible scenario, Britain would be worse off for leaving the European Union. But the real harm of Brexit has been to the nation's morale. Britain was always the sensible country. While France plunged into revolution, Russia committed suicide, and Germany sat out the 20th century in disgrace, Britain stayed the course. When Napoleon supposedly called Britain a nation of shopkeepers, what no doubt irritated him was that the British displayed none of the self-destructive tendencies of other nations. They put their economic interest before grand abstractions, and this held them in good stead. With Brexit, Britain may have committed its first truly self-destructive action since the English Civil War, nearly 500 years ago. What started out as a reckless expression of confidence has ended in embarrassment and deadlock. British politics, writes Helen Lewis in The New Statesman, despairing of both Prime Minister Theresa May and her counterpart Jeremy Corbyn, a grim, unreconstructed lefty, reminds me of a Land Rover stuck in a field. The wheels are spinning, mud is flying everywhere, but there seems to be no possibility of moving forward. It is in this context that the young royals appear so dazzling. They have provided the British people with some comfort, said a senior parliamentarian to me, abiding by the strict convention that British politicians never discuss the royal family publicly. He went on to add that English aristocracy has always absorbed new people, and that is why the royal family will survive, too. When I asked him about Princess Michael's secret to survival, he replied, "The mystique thing is not an issue anymore. It's a celeb culture, but in the case of the royals, there's the added attraction that what they have you cannot buy." He assured me that Meghan Markle had been incredibly well received, and that the British royal family were experiencing a golden period. Will and Kate had been quietly deployed to capital after European capital. They were in Scandinavia at the time of this writing, where they were conducting a kind of back-channel diplomacy, reminding people of all that we love about Britain, that curious mixture of pomp and cozy, sometimes giving us bear skins and Palladian piles, sometimes marmite, weak tea, and torn jumpers. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.